It's a milestone of sorts on the Rooks and Beckards podcast, if you consider 10 episodes a milestone. Yes, it's episode 10 of this thing that seems to be evolving from episode to episode. One thing that hasn't changed is me, your host, Ted. The other is my co-host, John Young. Sure, our topics vary, but we're pretty much the same guys. Hey, before we start the show, I want to share with you a nice direct message I got on Twitter from Doug Davies. It was about the discussion on Tom Petty in episode 9. And if you haven't heard episode 9 yet, just pause, go back to episode 9 and listen to that. He said he really liked the conversation and that I shared my views on why I'm not a fan. He said that he wasn't a fan either, but loves the Traveling Wilburys, the supergroup that Petty was in with George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne. And, I like that first album a lot, too. Also got some love on Apple Podcasts with a couple of reviews from listeners. I'll read one of them from M.K. Demas, who says about this podcast, "Professional, personable, witty, and wry. Rooks and Beckards is enjoyable on many levels. Ted's years of experience as an on-air personality, DJ, scholar, and teacher make this podcast a must-listen for those who like music, books, and smart banter." Aw, that kind of love really goes a long way in keeping me motivated to do this podcast. And speaking of this podcast, I do it as a hobbyist who loves music and literature. In other words, I don't get paid for this. So getting great feedback from you, the listener, is payment enough. So if you're on Apple Podcasts, leave a comment, leave a rating. That helps me a lot in terms of keeping my motivation level up. And it also boosts it on Apple. They have this little algorithm where the more comments you get, well, geez, suddenly it starts to rise up in recommendations. And that's a good thing. Hey, in this episode, John and I are going to talk about something most music listeners probably don't think too much about, and that's the structure of a song. John is a man of many talents, and being a musician is one of them. We're going to break down how a song is put together with examples, and to do that, John gets to put on his musician hat. So here we go. When it comes to songwriting, how do artists know they've created something that will get radio airplay? Well, it's kind of a crapshoot at times because there's no surefire formula to writing a hit song, but there is a structure to songwriting that we've become conditioned to. Well, until fairly recently when things started to change. John Young and I want to chit-chat about those changes in the Rooks and Beckards podcast. How's it going, John?
It's going great, Ted. How is it going with you, my brother?
I'm feeling fine. Now, before we started recording this episode, John and I were talking about an opinion piece that was written in the New York Times called "The Culture Warped Pop for Good." It's kind of a, awkward title. So basically what they're saying is that our culture has changed pop music for good. It's written by Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding, and like us, they have a podcast. Theirs is called Switched on Pop, which is based on a book they wrote back in 2019, which is called Switched on Pop: How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters. I thought John would be a great resource in understanding song structure because he's a songwriter and a musician. And on top of that, he's the morning show host on 95.3 KUIC. He's a teacher. He's even a counselor. He's got a full plate, so I feel super lucky to grab time with him each week for this podcast. So, John, I'm going to actually turn it over to you so folks can get a better understanding of what most would consider a standard song structure.
Well, thank you, Ted, and thank you for the sweet introduction. As the article points out, this article by Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding, that since about the 1960s, when pop music really took off, people can argue you had rhythm and blues, you know, going back to the 20s and musicians in the 50s that ultimately, gave us the rock and roll we started to enjoy in the 60s. But pop sensibilities and radio pop music and that kind of thing really started to blossom in the 1960s. We know that. And really what we got used to is hearing this verse chorus combination in a song. We've been spoiled. Okay. Does that make sense? I mean, in other words, yeah. you hear songwriters and performers and musicians telling a story in a pop song. They start off by telling a story in the verse and it crescendos up into the chorus. And we've gotten used to that song structure. In fact, when we don't hear that song structure, if you're old fossils like Ted and myself, you start to, and I won't put you in this category because you're so good about listening and enjoying and appreciating modern music. But I tend to wait for, I want to hear the hook, I want to hear the verse, and then I want to hear the chorus because I've been conditioned. That's what we've been hearing since about 1960.
Okay.
If you'll allow me to demonstrate, you can pick almost any band. We were talking about Tom Petty during the last...
That's right. That was a good discussion too, yeah.
A song like Mary Jane's Last Dance, which you had asked me if I had a favorite, that happened to be it. Where Tom Petty starts by telling a story before he gets to the chorus, you know, the verse where he's going... She grew up in an Indiana town, had a good-looking mom who never was around. But she grew up tall, grew up right with them Indiana boys on an Indiana night. So there you've got your story, right? You're following along.
That's the story. That's right.
Pretty soon we get to the chorus, which is, last dance with Mary Jane, one more time to kill the pain. You're ready to hear it, and then it comes right back to... Then we're going to tell some more story.
It's kind of like the verse kind of builds up to the chorus. It's like building a little bit of tension in a way, right?
Right.
Sometimes.
I think sometimes. And of course, it depends on the song. But that structure has given musicians and songwriters and performers and producers and the people behind the scenes a template to create, you know, most of the music we heard between, say, 1960 and I'll just cut it off at 1990. And the reason I cut it off at 1990, interestingly enough, is one of the songs that came out in 1990 that you are probably familiar with, the great band Nine Inch Nails, came out with Head Like a Hole in 1990. Right. That song was really one of the first to break that combination. That song has literally got two choruses, not a lot of verse. That song is two separate songs, literally just two really powerful choruses. Pick which one you like. I can't play it on acoustic guitar, so I won't try, but you can play a snippet of either one, of either part of that song, and you realize that song's just got two choruses. I'll just pick my favorite and scream it out at a Nine Inch Nails concert.
Good point. I didn't think about that, that the song kind of played with that first chorus structure by just saying, you know what? I got two catchy choruses here. I'm going to use them both.
Right. And that's
why not?
And that's why I kind of have framed that period of time where we were in that pop sensibility with verse chorus and sometimes verse pre-chorus chorus, where the story and the tension you talked about continues to build and they use a pre-chorus to build the tension up until we get to the chorus. Head Like a Hole and some of the industrial music that started to become popular in the early 90s. And now, of course, as you mentioned, we've got Billie Eilish and other musicians like her who have thrown out that template. And yet they're still finding an audience for people going, listen, I'm still grooving. Either I'm still dancing or I'm still contemplating or you're still creating a mood for me that puts me at a certain place in my mind or has a certain romantic connection to somebody I care about, whatever it is. I'm fascinated as a musician by how that's happening. We had the same structure for 30 years. How does a woman born in 2001 come up with a new one and everybody jumps on board, including the Grammys?
It is fascinating. And I think a lot of it is changes in the way in which we listen to music and technology in general, right? That we have, for better or for worse, we live our lives a lot on social media and we expect to be entertained constantly to get that sort of entertainment value. We want to get rid of the introduction, get rid of all the preface, the pre-chorus, just give me the meat of it. Give me the chorus, give me the hook. I was thinking about this the other day before we started recording. iTunes still does this, or it's Apple Music now, but if you wanted to preview a song, they used to give you just like a 30-second snippet. Do you remember that?
Yes, I did. And they were very particular about the snippet they gave you, right?
Exactly. But there's a whole generation, Billie Eilish included, who grew up in that era where they would just listen to the snippets of 30 seconds here and there and catch that sort of like, ooh, I like that part of the song, not the whole song, right? Because that would mean you got to pay 99 cents and mom and dad might not be happy to see that bill come out with, you know, 50 or 60 bucks to charge to iTunes. But anyway, but I think that that plus you get TikTok, and TikTok is huge, a huge driver in getting that 30 second snippet as the hook, as the meat, and as the most popular part of the song. So then songs start changing in that structure because of our attention spans start decreasing, that we just say, yeah, just skip all the preface, skip all the, you know, the fancy stuff. I don't need the real moody introduction. Give me the meat. Give me the chorus. Give me the hook right up front. And we see this with songs, and it's just like, well, the culture has changed, so of course the music's going to change as well. Now, whether the music is driving that change or the culture is driving the changes in the music, that's another question. But I wanted to get back to one thing that you mentioned, the pre-chorus. Now, what's the difference between a chorus and a pre-chorus?
The easy answer to that is a pre-chorus is a build. It's a build on the verse. You're singing about, you're working your way through a story, like Tom Petty was with The Last Dance of Mary Jane. That song doesn't have a formal pre-chorus. He goes right from the words talking about Indiana towns and whatnot to Last Dance with Mary Jane, one more time to kill the pain. He doesn't have another section. Now, he reserves that for guitar solos and for other things. But there are songs where you've got one more step to go before you get to that payoff, that chorus everybody's humming and singing and dancing along to. And there's several examples out there in the world. I wish one would, you know, occur to me right this second, because I'd play it for you. You can edit that part out. I'm trying to think.
I won't give you the one that that's in my head, and that's based on the opinion piece. But it was, "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman."
That's right.
The Franklin. I'm not going to make you have to sing that.
I know. You make me feel so tired. You're the key to my peace of mind. Cause you make me feel. You make me feel. You make me feel like a natural. To complicate matters even more, Ted, there's the bridge in certain songs too, where you're not just going verse and chorus. Now you've got a midsection area to you know, either accentuate what you're talking about. And I know in songs I've written before myself, one that I wrote with my good friend John Taylor and my good friends John Taylor and Randy Walker, "Little Things" has got a bridge that connects different parts of the songs. It's not a pre-chorus. It's we go verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus. We've got a bridge that's in the middle of the song that helps connect guitar solos and other thoughts. But
okay.
Does so that
the,
make sense?
The bridge serves as a way to connect these two parts of the song, but it also allows a musician like a lead guitarist to change the tone, maybe not the tone, but the style of the song, or just stand out in some way.
And like we've talked about, and I hate to bring KISS back into this discussion, but it always comes back to it, doesn't it?
It does, right. It's just a shorthand. What are you going to do?
Right. Depending on who your lead guitar player or your saxophone player or your, you know, glockenspiel player is, the solo can also accentuate and add something, almost a lyric in its own way, to the song. And bridges often get you to that point. And I can think of several songs right now that have that bridge and then dumping you into a guitar solo, which also helps get the point across of the song. Again, it's a structure we've all been working in for so many years, this idea of a verse, perhaps a pre-chorus, a chorus, perhaps a bridge, but ultimately the payoff is back to that chorus, back to that whole thing everybody's singing, the whole... Everything's in your head, and that's the song, and we're jamming, and we've got our fists in the air, and look at me, and somebody get me another beer. I spilled it on my buddy Rick here. Sorry, man.
Sometimes you can tell if you're at like a concert, everyone's waiting for the chorus because they all belt it out, right?
Right. Well,
that's how you know it's really powerful.
Sure. And I know you probably got this coming up, but the whole concept of the hook, you were talking about people in the Billie Eilish cohort who, you know, grew up sampling music for not having to pay as much to hear the whole thing and just getting to the meat of it, just getting to the great stuff. I think as a musician, I sure hope we don't lose the idea of having a riff or a hook, because those are the things that always grab me. That's sort of the key to opening the door to the song for me is whatever that riff is. And they come in all shapes and sizes, as you well know.
Billie Eilish is one good example, but hip hop is probably the preeminent example because of sampling. When hip hop artists were sampling records and they couldn't do that. They can't do that now without going broke. But you realize that the sample, whether it's a hook from a Jackson 5 song or James Brown or whatnot, that hook, that sample, that thing, it was like a shared moment where everyone's like, aha, yeah, that's that, whatever, that's some great music, or that really carries along the rhythm and the rap, because it's like referencing something. Like we reference Kiss a lot, right?
Right.
But in hip hop, they're referencing like a whole slew of things in pop culture. It can be from, you know, AM radio to TV to movies and things like that, or a song lyric or a chorus that they'll just drop in there because it becomes like this shared moment of, aha, this is our cultural, you know, this is our moment where we come together, or this is how it accentuates the rap because this is what I'm saying. And I'm using this hook as part of my creation here, that this is not just an original song, but I am clear about my references because I'm telling stories here. And this is part of my story or our story.
It's a really good point, Ted. In fact, Kiss is famous for, they're not famous for this, but Tone Loc sampled a bit of Christine 16 on Funky Cold Medina. The little drop down that is, you know, is a complete a complete funny sample. And you can't get away from Kiss. Even when you're discussing like, you know, 80s hip hop, they're still going to find their way into that conversation.
Damn you, Simmons and Stanley.
Damn you, Stanley. Wow.
We basically have been talking about hooks, and I thought, well, best way to explain it to most people, if you try to say a hook, you know, you're trying to explain it in a very sort of, you know, academic way. People are like, huh, what? But most people will say, well, I know a hook when I hear it. Okay. But I was on the University of YouTube and I was looking for answers on how does a hook come together or what are the elements of a hook? I happened upon this video by a guy named Gary Ewer. He teaches songwriting and he said, hooks have to have these elements. And he's listed like five of them. So many of them, most people are going to know. A catchy melodic fragment. Okay, that's easy. An enticing rhythm. Okay, I like that. A short but tonally strong chord progression. Now that's my moment where I go, huh? It's fun to sing and hum. And then it keeps the audience listening and entertained. I understand maybe four out of those five, but John, explain to us non-musicians what a chord progression is.
Okay, a chord progression is a series of chords in an order that is pleasing to one's ear. Now, pleasing is in the eye of the ear holder, so to speak. So if you've got a chord progression like D, A, E, I'm going to play those for you. It's fairly pleasant and it's fairly common. That's three chords in a progression going from D to A to E. So there's your chord progression. I might quibble with some of the ideas behind what you described, the description of how a riff comes about, because a riff can be as simple as that, as just going over and over again, or a riff can have more complexities and less chordal shading, something like Just Got Paid by ZZ Top. You know, where you're pulling and yanking, and that's on the guitar, by the way, you know, different parts of the guitar to produce that kind of a rumbling, funky sound. There's riffs come in all shapes and sizes, I guess. I would leave open the possibility that riffs can be easy. They can be chord-based, or they can be single note-based. They can be harmonic. They can be all kinds of things, as long as they are memorable and they are hummable to some degree.
So you said the word riff. What's the difference between a riff and a chord progression?
A chord progression can be a riff. Yes, you're okay. The one who pointed this out. You've got that Telecaster sitting somewhere around the podcast.
Somewhere here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you like, and I know you can bang out the AC/DC's Back in Black chord.
Just a little bit. I'm not very good at it.
Let me hear you.
I'm no John Young. Let's put it that way. You know what I mean?
I mean, you've got going. Right. I mean, you're doing an E, D, A thing.
Yeah. It's like right.
But when you, there you go.
Like that.
Ladies
right?
and gentlemen, so, Ted Asfricato on the guitar.
That first one wasn't very good. It was kind of crunched, you know?
That's what kinda I'm talking like about. Yeah. Now, when you hear that on the record or you hear him play it live, go to YouTube, whatever. It's very, very powerful. It's hummable. It kind of gets you out of your seat, right? It brings you to your feet to some degree. And that's just three powerful chords with a nice little riff he does to tie them together. And when I say riff, I mean that where he's going. But he does it about 300 times faster than.
Okay. So it's like a little spice.
Right.
There.
Riff can be part of a chord progression, but a chord progression can be a riff too. Now that ZZ Top example I gave you is all about picking and bending and whatever, but then it eventually resolves into a chord where it goes, well, I just got paid today. Got me a pocket full of change.
Now that part there, the sort of picking you're doing, that's a riff, right?
That's a riff. Yes, okay. That's a riff, but it still it glues together the power chords that create the song. So riffs, chord progressions, chords, verses, pre-choruses and choruses, it's all a fancy way of describing obviously how the song's constructed. And where we got this whole thing started was there was a construct from about 1960 again until late 80s that even some hip hop bands to some degree, Tone Loc and some of the others, followed that prescription for creating a song. Now, and I guess maybe wonderfully so, we've gone completely off that, although you still hear plenty of pop songs constructed that way. Now, there's no rule book anymore. So even if you're a guitar player playing acoustic, electric, you're not sampling, you don't have any keyboards, you got your drums and bass and electric guitars, you can still get a little crazy and go outside that song structure. And I'm excited by it because there's going to be more Billie Eilish's on the horizon creating stuff that you and I and people from our generation typically were locked into this. I won't put you in that because you're so much more avant-garde than other people your age, but guys like me are session musicians who've been playing the same kind of thing for years and years. It's good to have our world shooken up a little bit.
It gets you to think a little bit differently than falling into sort of habit in a way. Like you're thinking, well, you know, my musical influences are from, if it's the album era of the 70s and 80s, maybe some 60s, there's a certain song structure that's pretty common to that style of music, especially if it's in the rock category. So if it's in the rock category, and maybe you're influenced from the Beatles all the way to Nine Inch Nails or something, when things start to change, anything in between that, you're probably going, if you're a musician that loves that style of music, you're going to try and write music that's based on that, not genre. It's based on the chord progressions. It's based on the structure, really. Right. That's what it is. It's based on that structure.
Sure. It is hard to get songs like Margaritaville out of your head. It's a story. Sure. It's a song, but it's a story. And everybody, once you've had four or five shots of medium grade tequila, you're singing along. Even if the words are wrong, you don't care. You're nibbling on sponge cake, watching the sun bake. Is that right, Bob? I don't know. Give me another shot. Somebody have a lime? We're trying to break out of it, folks. And musicians and creators and influences are helping us do that. And to give you your due, Ted, you've been one of my friends who is my age, yet is so much hipper and is digging in deeper to some of that stuff out there. And I think those new musical creators appreciate you because we need more of you and less of me.
Well, John, I wanted to pull the curtain back on the radio industry because you and I both work in it and talk about something that a lot of musicians and the general public would like to know, which is how do you get your song played on the radio, right? Now, radio programmers usually hire these people called consultants. They have their own companies and they come in and they conduct these things called auditorium music tests. to get a sense of how an audience reacts to a song. And they do this with groups of people who represent essentially the demographic they're trying to reach. So if it's women between the ages of 25 and 54, they'll invite a bunch of women, 25 and 54, to sit in a room. At least they used to do this. And what they do is they play you a snippet of song. Gee, there's that snippet again, just like iTunes did. And they give you a controller, which you dial a number. So if you dial up, it means you like the song. If you dial down, it means you don't like the song that much. It has like a score between 0 and 100. So everyone who has that controller, they dial and they listen to these songs. And then it gets fed into a computer and they crunch the numbers, and then scores are assigned to each of the songs. Now, the songs that score higher get added to a playlist. So it's really difficult to get a song, especially a song from an unsigned band or artist, on a commercial radio station if you don't have major label support. Now, does that mean you should stop writing music? Absolutely not. Just keep doing it. No one knows what an audience is going to react to. Consultants know what audiences will probably like within a demographic, but they're choosing songs that are usually proven hits, songs that are older, songs that have a familiarity about it, whether it's an artist or there's something about the song that sounds like something that came before, something that would appeal to that demographic. We're talking about Billie Eilish throughout this podcast because she's a good example of that. But hip hop is also, like I said, the preeminent example, because in the past 10 to 15 years, what has been the dominant way to make music? It's on your computer. How do you do that? You figure out how to loop beats, create your own beats, and maybe either rap over it or you sing, and you build up with these synthetic instruments, these, you know, not real instruments, just all that's all programmed onto a computer in a loop. And you create essentially the bed and the music track of a song to which you can write lyrics over it. Now, we use Billie Eilish as an example because she had one of the biggest successes with that very process. She had a song called Ocean Eyes that her brother Phineas wrote in 2015. They loaded it up on SoundCloud, and lo and behold, this thing takes off like a wildfire. It's huge, right? Burning cities and napalm skies, 15 flares inside those ocean eyes, your ocean. Musician out there, and you're trying to think, how do I get my song on the radio? Use what's available to you. Use the internet, how it's available. Grow your audience. But if you think you can walk down to your local radio station, like 95.3 KUIC, and say, here's my song. Do you think you can play it, John Young? John's probably going to say, yeah, I'll listen to it, but I don't think I can just, like, you know, walk into the studio and put it on the air. It just doesn't work that way.
My heart hurts. And you know what? A lot of times it's the parents or the partner of somebody who's done something amazing, but they're not, you know, on a major label. You're right. They haven't been sent to the auditorium to have Sylvia from Elk Grove give the numbers up on the controller. And I'm often giving them the same advice that you just gave the audience, Ted, which is please don't stop creating. Just because I can't play your song on a radio station that only focuses on major label artists who've already been proven and already, you know, been tested and whatnot, and have already sold umpteen millions of copies or had umpteen millions of downloads, that's not a reason to stop creating. And Billie and Phineas Eilish are perfect examples of young people who didn't give up at all. In fact, I don't know that they cared that much when they started writing and producing their own music in their parents' house, whether it was going to get radio play or not. And of course, that brings up the whole issue of, you know, how much do you need radio play to achieve your artistic dreams now that we have all these other platforms with which to expose your music to?
The good thing about radio is it reaches so many people. Everybody still listens to the radio. I mean, it's still a pretty popular medium to listen to music and to get exposed to new music. So I don't want to, you know, sort of bite the hand that feeds us and say, well, radio schmadio. But while the bar to entry on the internet is super low, anyone can do it. Like, they can get a SoundCloud account, write a song and put it on there and see what people think. you're probably not going to get beyond a few dozen, if that, people listening to it, if you're lucky. Radio has the advantage of reaching a massive audience, and a lot of people are going to hear it. And it also has that familiarity of voices like John Young in the morning, who, if he said, you know, here's the latest from blah, 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 and I really like this song, well, then suddenly that comes like, oh, John likes it? Let's hear what this is about. I'm going to perk up my ears a little bit. That's different from saying, you know, I'm on SoundCloud and my nickname on SoundCloud, if I made something up like Fuzzy Slippers 593, yes, loves this. It doesn't carry as much weight. You know, it just doesn't.
It's a very good point, Ted. Yeah, radio has a reach that is undeniably awesome. I would just add the caveat that some of these artists who you hear on the radio, especially now that we're getting older, the radio medium is older. Sure, it's still relevant. Obviously, we don't want to bite that hand because it does feed us. Yes. Thank you, son. I did get your message. Yes, you need money sent to Oklahoma. I get it. Where my son's at OU right now. I get it. But we don't want to stifle the creativity that starts in maybe your parents' basement or over at your friend's house with $800 worth of equipment you got from Guitar Center. And all of a sudden, that creative flow is happening, and you might be the next person to take it to the next level where someone hears it and goes, wait a minute, that's a hook that maybe I remember from 1960. But all of a sudden I'm thinking, wait a minute, you just put a new twist to it. You put some samples in there. You've got a French horn solo that was never part of it. Bring it on. I want to see that continue because I think that's where we're getting the Billie Eilishes. That's where we're getting Doja Cat. It's where we're getting some, you know, we're getting Dua Lipa. We're getting amazing artists that didn't come with that 60s baggage we started the podcast talking about.
Doja Cat is a good example because that song has the riff from In Excess.
Yeah.
Right? Need
yes,
You Tonight.
Yes, uh-huh.
The kind of bum, bum, bum. But it's familiar, right? And it's a great hook, you know?
Every time I hear it, I just want to go on. Give me a Stratocaster and let me just play that funky guitar line for you on tour for the next 6 months, Doja Cat.
Exactly.
Please.
Exactly. And you talked about some of the gear that people are buying now, and it's super cheap. In fact, sometimes it's free. If you have a Macintosh computer, they load GarageBand on there for free. And you could go and say, well, I've learned everything I can learn off GarageBand because it's limited in what it can do. But they also will sell you a program called Logic, which is what Phineas and Billie Eilish use. Well, it's Phineas really used to create that record and some of the songs prior to that. But it works similarly. If you look at the interface for Logic and GarageBand, they look very similar, but Logic can do so much more. You can manipulate the sounds. You've got probably a vaster library of loops that you can use to create your soundtrack. So you don't need to, say, spend $4,000 on a Gibson Les Paul made in the United States and then spend your, you know, 10,000 hours trying to learn it and master this instrument when you can start with loops and Logic. And if you've got to use those 10,000 hours to build something up. Now, that's one part of the last 10 years that we've seen. However, what I noticed about the Grammys is that people are using real instruments more.
Yes,
it's
they
not
are.
So much.
Yes,
I noticed that, which I'm thrilled about because when I'm watching like some, you know, pop artists or somebody from hip hop and they have a horn section, they've got real drums, a real bass guitar. And I'm all like, this is great. This is great. They don't have to rely on these, you know, loops and electronic creations in their bedrooms anymore. They're actually playing with real musicians. And that has that gives the music a different vibe to it.
And it's the vibe, Ted, that we started this podcast off talking about, built on that tried and true method of verse and chorus with riffs and chords and hummable pieces of music that make you come back to it. I believe that has something to do with using live musicians with real instrumentation, even with a dash of electronica thrown in there. But the idea of having a real drummer keeping the beat, the idea of having a real bassist keeping that bottom end going, real guitar players with the human error that comes with it, that gives it that sense of life that sometimes real hard industrial stuff that's completely digitized doesn't have. Although I still think you and I need to form a band called Loops and Logic. The perfect Tedism that we're going to keep from today's podcast. I'm Ted and I'm John, and we play in Loops and Logic.
Loops and Logic.
What's wrong with that? Huh? Come on, man. Do you know how many pints of plasma I had to donate in the 80s to pay for the kind of stuff that you can now download for free? I mean, right. Goodness sakes, you make a great point there, my friend.
The way in which that this current way of crafting songs, pop songs, hip hop songs, whatever, that is very popular right now. To me, rock music is ripe to pick some of this up because there's still rock music being played. It's sort of like after the Grammys, I got a text from a friend says, well, if you look at the Grammys, rock is clearly dead. And I said, no, it's in hibernation. And I said, it's actually a good thing that it's in hibernation because the genre of rock is not going to go away, but I think it's ripe for a revision or a kind of revolution within it. So things that are being done now in pop music can easily filter down into rock music and make it more interesting and exciting in some way.
I agree with you 100%. And that was my point about don't stop writing and creating, people, because for every Billie Eilish, there might be a new, you know, a new guitar god or goddess that emerges from all this kind of practice and you know, 10,000 hours of work in their parents' basement, whatever it is. That reset for rock is going to come from the next generation. I don't know that it's going to come from me, a 56-year-old guitar player drummer who tries desperately to be as hip as I possibly can, but I'm turning to this new energy that we feel all around us in music and art. And that's where it's going to come from. I believe a reset's a good idea. And maybe we're going to come out even stronger on the other end of this thing.
On that, I think we're going to end the podcast. This is our 10th podcast, by the way, together.
Wow.
And one of the things that I said at the outset, which was, you know, each podcast is a little different, but John and I remain the same, and that will be set going forward. That's not going to change. But I think the podcast is starting to evolve. I mean, it's clear that you and I have such a passion for music that our discussions of music are the most energetic on the podcast. So I think as we go forward, the Rooks and Beckards podcast is going to start to evolve a little bit. It'll be certainly, we're still going to reference books, but it might not be the segments that I've been doing in the past where I have John in one segment, and then I take a couple of other segments and I talk about a book or an album of sorts. We're still going to talk about these things. We're still going to talk about books. We're still going to talk about records, but it's not going to be as segmented as it was going forward. So John's going to be certainly a part of that. And I'm thrilled to have him with his knowledge and his enthusiasm and his humor to make this podcast much more entertaining for folks and informative out there.
I will do everything I can, Ted, not to get fired.
I don't have that kind of power. John, as always, thank you so much for being on the Rooks and Beckards podcast and being a wonderful co-host.
Listen, I love you, Ted. Thanks again, brother. Take care of yourself.
Okay, it's another Rooks and Beckards episode put to bed. Thanks for taking the time to listen. If you like what you hear, please subscribe. I've posted the podcast on all the major platforms like Apple, Amazon, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google. So wherever you get your podcasts, the Rooks and Beckards podcast is probably available there. Until next time, I'm Ted, and I'll be back soon to talk more about music and books, and sometimes books about music on the Rooks and Beckards podcast.